I'm really happy to be here. And my thanks to the Adelot Foundation and to Aaron and Pam Shropshire for making this whole series happen. The Social Science Cafe is a neat idea. Science Cafe was neat before, and I'm sure Humanities Cafe will be fabulous too. So I want to talk a little bit about this, one of the two projects that I'm working on now, on citizen education, civic education at the higher ed level. But before I do that, I just want to talk a little bit about the work that Aaron referenced already, simply to contextualize it and show you the larger arc of how the different things have been connected that I've been working on. And so this was the book here that I had worked on, Tension Deficit Democracy. And the subtitle is Paradox of Civic Engagement. And it was really a lot on trying to clarify our thinking, clarify our language, really, and clarify our thinking. Because there had been this gigantic cottage industry around civic engagement that had grown up over a 20-year period or so. Our own Bob Putnam was one of the major figures, one of the biggest figures in driving that. But he really invented the term civic engagement, and it was so popular. It struck a chord with so many people that it took off, and it soon became quite elastic. And people were using it to describe just about everything under the sun. And that was a problem, because people were not only making descriptions and diagnoses about democracy, but also prescriptions about what makes democracy work better. And so if we were all kind of talking past each other, there was an issue and a problem. So what I tried to do, among other things — there were a lot of things going on in that book — one of the things I was talking about was whether there was really a narrative of decline that was undeserved, and whether actually things had always been kind of bad for democracies and attention since way back to ancient Greece, but whether there were particularly bad things now for people who weren't paying attention. So who gets hurt the most when they don't pay attention? How can things be made better so that those who are most likely to be hurt by political disengagement aren't hurt as much by that? But so what I tried to do was look at this, at the term engagement itself, because that's become kind of a buzzword too. And this actually is going to relate to what I want to talk about with civic engagement as well, civic education as well. Actually, engagement over a 500-year period, if you look at the OED and look at the usage over a super long period of time, it's tended to connote a combination of attention and activity, a consciousness of purpose, but also a follow-through of an investment of energy as well. And that investment of energy, that kind of action component, is going to be important for the civic education piece as well. And really, when we worry about decreasing engagement, which we do at very high levels now, we worry about psychological engagement, academic, scholastic engagement, consumer engagement, as well as the civic variety. We're really worrying about the elusiveness of these resources, attention and activity or energy, which are really vital for any kind of collaboration and yet are difficult to sustain. The issue was, though, whether civic was not way too broad of a term to be characterizing what makes democracy work. Because we had some people saying that, therefore, bowling leagues were what's necessary. Others said that, actually, no, it's patriotism. That's what civic engagement is. That's necessary. Others said charity. Still others said voting. Some said art. And they were so all over the place. I wanted to say, basically, with this book, to the entire cottage industry, essentially Mandy Patinkin's line from The Princess Bride:
"You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means."
Right. And so, right? Civic, no. So what I suggested was that actually it's better thought of as the component parts: political, social, and moral engagement, which can go together, but they don't always. They don't have to. And it was useful, I thought, to break those down. I was really mainly writing about political engagement in that book. Our own Bob Putnam really wrote the Bible on social engagement, social capital, with a couple of his different books. One of the things that I'm working on now that I'm not going to talk about is the book that Aaron mentioned on moral engagement and disengagement, and how moral engagement, which is to say not just consciousness and attention to the right or to certain moral principles, but also a purposive follow-through, doing the right thing also, how that might lead to the possibility of something, a concept like moral capital. I think that social capital is way over-generalized and moral capital is under-theorized. It's very often people use the term social capital to describe things like trust, which is really a moral attitude when you get down to it. And there are all kinds of examples of people who do utilize others' resources to get done important things. Martin Luther King Jr. comes to mind, Archbishop Ferdinand. People who are able to marshal great resources of other people without ever having met them, without being in their social networks. It's very difficult to call it social capital, but really it's because of what those leaders are supposed to represent, which is a kind of moral engagement, standing for the right principles and actually having the courage to follow through on them. Of course, ordinary people are also able to marshal moral capital as well. And I think it's very possible, too, that sometimes our societal stores of moral capital may be leached up or dried up by occasional scandals, crises, or confidence games. That's one of the things I'm looking at that I'm interested in, but it's not this other thing. The other thing that what I'm going to want to talk about today, then, is three things. I just mentioned this sort of civic engagement project that I was doing, clarifying our discourse, and looking at the question of whether there had been a decline. And there's often a kind of behind these narratives of decline an idea that there was some sort of golden age, if not a perfect golden age, something, 1950s, for example, that when things were better, and we've gone down from there. And I tried to say some things to temper that impulse. Well, what I'm working on now, aside from the moral engagement, then, is civic education, which has also got a clarifying aspect to it. Because very often, we're not very clear on what we actually mean by civic education, or what it means for colleges to advance citizenship, or to produce citizens. There are also narratives of decline in civic education. Now, most of the literature on civic education is at the K-12 level. But there is still a fairly robust field in higher ed. I have been aided in my reading on this by a very exceptional undergraduate, Ben Roebuck, who's sitting over there. And we've gone through quite a lot of literature, both on mission statements of colleges, on lots of literature being put out by scholars, as well as former presidents, as well as office holders, writing about apparently a crisis in civic education and wondering what colleges, as well as K-12, should do about it. And at the very end, I'm going to consider whether we might actually be entering something like a golden age, even if there hasn't been a golden age up until now. I want to tell you, I am not somebody who is well disposed towards sort of golden age narratives. Almost, I'm the person, I think most of us are, the people who are like, well, look, it wasn't so great, it wasn't so bad either, and you know, things right now, they're not so great, they're not so bad too. And yet, it's just possible there may actually be some good news, both for the liberal arts and for civic education that I want to consider by the end. What really led me to this stuff was my great fortune in being selected to work with an exceptional organization, and that is, one second here, let's see, oh, that was what I just was talking about. This is the organization, it's Project Pericles. This is Gene Lang's consortium of colleges that look at and are committed to citizenship education, collaboration between campus and the local communities. And a few years ago, I wrote a white paper along with Jan List, who is the executive director of Project Pericles, trying to look at, there was the other 20, so I'm the Periclean faculty leader for this campus. Just meant that I did some community-based learning classes and I got to go to some meetings. There are 25 other ones at other campuses. We looked at what they've accomplished, what we've learned from that, what our successes have been, what the challenges have been. And I learned a lot about civic education at the higher ed level and wanted to write more about it. These are the member schools right there. Some, there is really quite a big range. Some are HBCUs, some are small liberal arts colleges like us, some are larger than us too. But so what we were doing then in this was looking at lots of syllabi, lots of, including the challenges were very important. Very often we don't note the challenges, we just want to talk about what the positives are. And we try to be honest about what the challenges were in there too. In doing a lot of recent research, I've just seen a lot of woe is me tales about civics and citizenship education and civic education, again, at K-12 and at the national level. So this was here, these narratives of decline. They're very easy. And there are narratives of decline. I see historian friends here. There are narratives of decline throughout history. They're very easy to tell ourselves. Even kids sometimes will tell narratives of decline. So this was a recent op-ed. It's just one of like 50 that I could have put in there. That talks about a decline of civic education and the liberal arts. Here, by the way, is a kid telling a narrative of decline.
Bart, my birthday is in 2 days. I'm going to be 8 years old. It's a big number, almost double digits.
Well, enjoy it while you can. Everything changes when you hit the big 1-0. Your legs start to go. Candy doesn't taste as good anymore.
All right, so I think it goes very deep in us. But this article is like a lot of other ones, and it's deeply flawed and mistaken, I think. in its conceptualization of what citizenship and civics are. But at least it does one thing right. I'll talk about what the mistake is in a second. But the really good thing that it does do, which is not usually done, I think it does it inadvertently, really, is if you look at the headline there, all right, the decline of civic education and liberal arts, it puts them together. It says they're both declining. That's the real problem is, and they're declining separately, and we should worry about both of those. What it gets right inadvertently is they are inextricably connected in ways that we don't often realize, that really the business of the liberal arts is, among other things, because there's a lot of different business of the liberal arts, but it's education for citizenship. It's just that we need to conceptualize citizenship in a very broad way such that it goes across the curriculum. All right, there are classes in all the divisions that really address different aspects of citizenship, issues of morality and ethics, issues of identity, issues of culture, issues of power and exclusion. There's a very wide gamut. This does not do that. If you take a look at what they're complaining about down here, they're talking about college graduates are woefully ignorant about fundamental academic skills and the basics of citizenship. They don't know the length of members of Congress terms. They can't identify the general at the Battle of Yorktown or the father of the US Constitution. Those are nice things to know. I want my kids to know them. That's not what actually makes for effective citizenship. It's not what makes for effective advocacy. It's not even what makes for ethical concern or the ability to collaborate with others. Now, I think it's the case that we really do need to do a much better job at the K-12 level. Things like No Child Left Behind and other lots of other policies have crowded out civic education, except at those places that don't need it as much. The wealthiest places are the ones most likely to have electives like civic education. One thing that college students may be able to do, because really if people don't know some of these basics by the time they come to us, we're not going to be able to completely, you know, revolutionize their understanding. So many other things they're going to do when they come here. What's more, and this is, I think, probably obvious to a lot of you as I'm talking, a lot of our students aren't American citizens and aren't going to be American citizens. And the idea, the notion, the conceit of actually using college as a way to drill in this sort of how-to manual about how to do certain things at this particular point in time in American citizenship is, I think, wrong-headed. But it gets us thinking in the right direction because it puts civic education and the liberal arts together. One of the things that our students can do is to develop so one of the really neat innovations in civics education is what's sometimes called civics 2.0 or action civics. The idea at the K-12 level mainly of getting students out of the classroom, getting them to work collaboratively on real political problems, getting them to meet with local leaders, getting them to actually be able to then not just pay attention, but actually invest their energy as well. And our students are able to with our ed department, and not just our students, but students at lots of colleges, I think are able, well equipped, to help to teach those things to K-12 students and learn some of it themselves, come to the kind of mastery that you only get through teaching. And that's something that is appropriate for the college level. So what I was then saying was here is that there is, the first one was that in civic education, there's narratives of decline that aren't really warranted, although there are problems with lack of political engagement, but there's not really a warranted declensionist narrative. And the same thing goes for civic education. There really wasn't a golden age. Sometimes you'll see people pointing to early 20th century. There's a lot of rhetoric in president statements and in mission statements about Harvard, Yale, and Princeton all did this, talked about the making of citizens and the making of a Harvard man. Not only is the model of citizen not what we probably want to promulgate, it was also a very elite core of people that were really learning to be leaders among each other. They were often all male as well. But as well, there's a big gulf between what the lip service was and what actually went on in the curriculum. We're actually poised to do a lot more to keep students active and to help them learn some of a broad definition of citizenship than happened in some of the so-called high periods. Well, then the question is, and I'm going through a bunch of stuff now, so I'm not going to go deeply into a lot of it. There are turf battles. All right, well, what can higher ed do if it's not the case that we're just going to be teaching civics as they used to do, in the K-12 level, how to do this and that with your local representative? What can we do? What I want to do with this is to take a look at two different polarizing figures, those are Martha Nussbaum and Stanley Fish. And they're really writing very opposing, competing narratives about what it is that college and higher ed should or shouldn't do. Nussbaum recently wrote this book called Not for Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. She's connecting democracy and citizenship and the humanities. And then Stanley Fish, who in much more curmudgeonly fashion writes Save the World on Your Own Time. And the book says just what it sounds like it says. So let me first take a look at Nussbaum's work, which is very rich. It's in keeping with a bunch of other things she's done. But it's also it's a polemic. It's a polemic that's perceiving the humanities in under fire, both at the college level but also K-12, and making a case for why they're actually essential. So here are a couple of things she wants to point to. In part of her book, she writes that we schools were distracted by the pursuit of wealth, and so we increasingly ask our schools to turn out useful profit makers rather than thoughtful citizens. And this choice of verbs is really important to her. It's to turn out, as if there's a churning out, a production model. I think she very sensitively gets at some aspirations, especially in tough economic times, to do this. The problem is that because she is writing a polemic and she's writing from a defensive stand, she is trying to show that actually you want to turn out profit makers. Well, we can turn out something else. We can turn out citizens. She writes about John Dewey that he lived and taught in a thriving democracy and the production of active, curious, critical, and mutually respectful democratic citizens was his central goal. And it's not an accident. On about 20 different occasions, she uses words like this. Colleges can't convey the type of learning that produces global citizens unless they have a liberal arts structure. And this is a real flaw to me. It's a problem. I think it's a problem to think about higher ed as producing any particular thing, including scholars. Not all of our students go on to do that, and including citizens, including business people. And Fish gets that. He actually makes the point he doesn't just have Nussbaum in his sights, but he writes that learning how to perform in the game of argument, that's no guarantee of the quality or the morality of the arguments you go and make. You can make bad arguments, bad decisions, bad actions if you're Phi Beta Kappa as well as if you're a member of a street gang. And he didn't consult this, but there is evidence on that. There is a philosopher who's written about whether ethicists are more moral, more ethical than others. I don't mean to offend the ethicists here, but he finds that they're not. They're not more ethical, and in some cases, they're actually worse. They're less good at keeping to their demanding standards. The same thing goes, political scientists aren't radical. He also looks at whether political scientists vote more and whether they're radically better citizens. There's all kinds of ways in which people who dedicate their lives to the study of a thing don't then become exemplars of that thing. So why should we expect our students to have that kind of transformation? We're not going to prepare them and produce them for everything.
Harvard did not prepare me for this.
So, Harvard didn't prepare, and neither does Swarthmore. Harvard, we don't prepare you for everything, is the point of that little clip in there. So I think he does have a point against Nussbaum in that. The problem with Fish is he takes it way, way over the edge. Right? So he says that, he has some points even in here. Teachers should teach materials and skills. They shouldn't do a lot of other things. They shouldn't try to produce active citizens, inculcate virtue and that sort of thing. Now, they might produce some of those outcomes. They might actually produce the outcome, the opposite too. You can't tell what's going to happen with the student in your class. But it's contingent. It's not what's aimed at. And so here's the heart of the matter, the justification, because he's getting that people are scared. They're running defensive. And so we're trying to say, well, how can we justify this thing? Well, we produce this. We produce business leaders, or we produce scholars, or we produce citizens. So is that really going to happen, any of these things? His answer on this is no, 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 and no. And the problem he's worried about is that we're going to give ammo to those who are against higher ed if it turns out that we actually fail in these lofty claims. So he says, beware of doing something for an external reward. Do it for its own reward. Now, Fish just goes way too far with this. He references Plato, but Plato gives us the possibility of there being a good which is good for its own sake. Whoa, that was unintended. Wow. I meant to do that. Good for its own sake. And also good for what it produces, too. Justice is that kind of good. And it may be the case that liberal education can also be good for its own sake while also being able to produce positive things. The issue is that just because it doesn't produce something doesn't mean that these results are completely contingent, couldn't have been guessed at. There are strong correlations of people going to liberal arts colleges, people going to higher ed, and then going on and being more active citizens. There are even correlations between them doing other kinds of things like being business leaders too. Really comes down to something that Nussbaum could say against Fish, but she doesn't in this book. She says in earlier work of hers. Nussbaum is a really wonderful expositor of capabilities theory, often with Amartya Sen. She doesn't write about capabilities here. She writes about producing products. But here's what she could have said, because she says it in other writings of hers. The capabilities approach holds that the key question to ask when you look at different societies, don't look at GDP, that sort of thing. Look at what is each person able, really substantively able to do and to be. Capabilities aren't just abilities that are inside of us. It's also the freedom or opportunity that's produced by my abilities, but also the whole environment. So it's not just that you can say, hey, you can be president, you know, eat your vegetables. No, there actually has to be institutions that allow for meaningful engagement. However, then it's focused on freedom. And so once you have these capabilities that college is able to give you, for example, then you may or may not exercise them. The choice is yours. That is, of course, what higher education does. It does that with citizenship. It does it with scholarship. Not all of our citizens go, our students go on to be scholars, probably a good thing, right? And it does it with business also. There's even some evidence recently about that came out about median annual earnings. And this chart here basically goes against the idea that all liberal arts, especially humanities people, even with master's degree, are going to be fit only for working in a fast food store or working in a comic store.
Freaking kids, I do not need this. I've got a master's degree in folklore and mythology.
Mythology got cut off a little bit. So you see here, this is the humanities and social sciences actually outpace pre-professional and professional degrees by the time people get to kind of peak earning years in here. The only reason I put, and of course, there are engineering and science, which can be part of the liberal arts too, that are much higher. I don't put this up there to say, hey, look, we produce good wage earners. That's not my concern. The point is we don't. We don't produce them. We develop capabilities. And the same thing goes for what we do with citizenship. Right? It's not because of what we teach them in economics, again, no offense to economists or accounting, that they're doing better here than pre-professional majors. It's because of the capabilities that we inculcate. So I think it's a much better way of thinking about it, and the Nussbaum had available to her. I'm really reading with Nussbaum against Nussbaum in this particular case. So, all right, a few more things I want to get at. That was just the same basic graph. So this is where we've been thus far. That was the first thing I talked about. This is civic education, clarifying the discourse, really trying to get at over-promising what Nussbaum is doing in her polemic versus under-promising, which Fish radically does, and getting at that by this juxtaposition of products versus capabilities. I now want to look at just briefly at this question of, well, is it possible we could be entering at the higher ed level something like a new golden age? And the things they'll have to do, and I'll just gesture at them now without actually going into that deeply, is redefining civic education, or defining it in the first place in a relatively clear way. Stressing the importance of citizenship broadly conceptualized residing across the liberal arts curriculum. And mapping civic education. And this is one technical innovation that is very exciting. We've started to do it here. Other schools have started to do it too. We don't just do it for civic education. We do it for, we're starting to think about, Matt Zucker's been thinking about curricular mapping for the curriculum at large too. So that's what I want to just get at briefly in the next maybe sort of 5 to 7 minutes or so. So I wrote this piece this past year for a symposium in Political Science Journal on whether teaching and research have to be opposed. And my argument was that they don't. And I called it Playing on Dewey's classic work, Experience and Education. I called it Experience and Civic Education. And one of the purposes of this, I was also looking at different Pericles schools and what some of their professors had done in terms of publication, and what some of our professors had done, people like Keith Reeves and Lynn Schofield, to combine teaching and research. But one of the things I pulled out, this just makes it big here, bigger, is me saying that, look, don't try to go and teach civics. Right. There are people who actually think that's what sort of political science ought to be doing. Don't do that. That's not where our comparative advantage lies. Really, we're thinking about civic referring to maybe national citizenship, but also a range of other citizenships, a range of human relationships and identities and rights, very, very broad. Now, of course, you're going to have to encounter in your social science, natural science, and humanities classes a vigorous engagement with critical reasoning, ethical principles, pluralism, understanding political systems, knowing something about scientific methods so you can have debates about things like global warming. That's it. That's liberal arts education. And so really what I was saying there then is that Wait a second here. This is a book, by the way, by Bob Graham and a professor. It's called America, an Owner's Manual, and it's really saying, actually, yes, we should. What political science should do is teach civics. It should just teach people what Michael Oakeshott called a text. We should teach them a finite body of knowledge, which may be expired in 5 years. It may be obsolete then, but it's going to be as opposed to what Oakeshott wanted us to teach at the higher ed level, this British philosopher Michael Oakeshott, which is languages. All of our disciplines are languages. They're lenses through which you can view the world. That's what the business of teaching capabilities is about, not texts, finite bodies of knowledge that, again, may be like refrigerator repair or something like that that could be expired within a few years. So in this, I wrote here that we want to conceptualize civic education rightly. And really, it resides across the curriculum, across all the different subfields. And so right now, I just want to look at three different classes that do that, that came out of my work with Project Pericles. This was a class taught by T.J. Eatman. So the book I'm working on, it's got three middle chapters, in addition to all the theory and history stuff that's in there, three middle chapters on natural science or STEM stuff, social science, and humanities, and how civic education can work at each of those levels with real examples. T.J. Eatman at Allegheny teaches an environmental science class that's just absolutely unbelievable. He uses aquaponics in it. And so the students grow vegetables through using aquaponics. They feed fish with those. They then sell the fish at local markets, and then they use the profits to go and reinvest back in. It's a sustainable system, and they educate local school children about this as well. It's very cool. It involves a lot of scientific learning. It's more like a capstone, right? The thing is that not everyone can do. I didn't come here to then say, like, everybody's got to do a class like this, because we have so many things that are weighing on our time. We don't all need to. We need to have some resources dedicated to supporting them, and then they may be able to be capstones for lots of our other classes that do bits and pieces of citizenship and civic education across the curriculum. This was at New England College, an arts class. It was taught by Inez McDermott, who was an art historian, and Maura McNeil, who's a writer. And it was on the New Hampshire town meeting, so there was a political aspect to it also. But really, too, they were not only going to meetings and writing about the meetings, too, but going and surveying art in the New England area, local township art, and architecture of different town halls, and writing about that, too. And that, too, was a kind of capstone class. And for one more capstone, there's Keith Reeves's Politics of Punishment class. Again, something that brings in sociology, politics, philosophy, economics. And there are a bunch of classes here that do that. Nina Johnson teaches those kind of gateway and capstone things too. The issue, all I want to do to flag here is these are very time-intensive classes. They're fabulous. They do help with the action component, and we don't all have to do them. And this is where the curricular mapping thing comes in. It's the last thing I will talk about. Citizenship across the curriculum is demonstrated by mapping civic education. So Project Pericles got some funding from the Teagle Foundation and sponsor. They wanted each of the different Periclean institutions to try to map their curricula by according to just three criteria. It was an inchoate effort. Now Jennifer McGee did a fabulous job with this and coded all kinds of courses according to whether they began to look at issues of social responsibility, whether they introduced students all separately to the ability to look with different lenses across different systems, and also whether they had an action component to them. I'm just going to put up a couple of things here. That's the ability to recognize issues of social concern. It's very broad. Lots of classes do that. It's one of the components of citizenship. That's the ability to relate academic materials to practical applications, and that's the motivation and capacity, the action component. I just want to show a couple of pages from this. You don't need to see all these things. I just chose these because that's chemistry, right? That's economics. Now, these are hitting primarily on the one, on the first one, the ability to look at issues of social concern from multiple perspectives. It's not so much always the practical application, but lots of classes have these kind of components that relate broadly to a broad conception of citizenship and communities. This was English literature, full of classes that have the English department's got literature classes that touch on violence, identity, globalization. So there are a number of things in there as well. This was some more English classes in there. These are all the ones that are being hit there. Then, though, in religion, there are other classes like this, too. Humanities is rich with classes like this. The sciences are as well. But we don't want to make all the different classes that have to have necessarily practical application. Some of us love living in the bubble, and that's fine. We have people living in the bubble of Swarthmore, and there's people who want to be doing bubble navigation on the outside and applying stuff. That's fine, right? What we need to be is purposive. Help the students to be intentional about their choice collection, their choices of classes, and make a much, much, much bigger map which has maybe 10, 12 categories, action components, all many different things that we together would have to come together and talk about. Well, what do we think citizenship does touch upon? It's discursive. Every school would be somewhat different in this particular regard. And then come up with not only a way to code these things, but also then a way to have something like an algorithm, a mapping program for students to sit down and say, all right, also, these classes kind of fit well together. There's a literature class on globalization. There is Aisha Kaya's class on globalization in political science and IPE. There is something on global religions. And now there's a capstone class that involves some kind of an action and come together in that way. It's a way of parsing our resources and using them more effectively. And it's not just us. But the reason I say us is, and what's exciting to me is, that this is all about the liberal arts. It doesn't necessitate us being a pre-professional school. It doesn't necessitate us all being political scientists or economists. It means we do what we do, but just in a purposive way and help students to navigate their way through this. So I have just one or two, I think, last things to pull together. Let's see here. This is where I am right now. Civic Education Now, Redefining Civic Ed, which I'm in the process of trying to do, citizenship across the liberal arts curriculum, mapping civic education. Those things all together, I think, can help to get us to a place where we don't need to overpromise, and that we recognize also that life doesn't end with the end of 4 years. People go, one of the reasons for why there are strong correlations between college graduates and then people who are more active in the world is it opens up gateways for them. Of course it does. It's not just a fair thing where then the resources societally are all distributed fairly and we all get to go to Swarthmore and use those resources. What we'd like them to do is use them responsibly. But life comes along afterwards. My father's a lawyer, and he would always say to me, you know, you can take a con law class in college. That's great. It's going to be really interesting. You go to law school, they're going to totally reteach you constitutional law. And then if you become a lawyer, they're going to reteach you again entirely. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. It doesn't end at the end of college. Life experience is really important. As long as you understand that, we're going to be all right.
All right, leeches. I want you to see what a good writer looks like. His name is Abraham Simpson, and he's got something you couldn't get at your fancy schools. Life experience.
Actually, you know, I wrote my thesis on life experience. And
quiet!
So, as long as we don't fall into the trap of thinking we can teach everything and produce everyone, we will be okay. And so, even though I'm really somebody who has very tempered narratives, generally speaking, I do feel optimistic now. I think that my usual impulse is with Benjamin Franklin in Poor Richard's Almanac to say the golden age never was the present age. It's usually whenever you were 12 or something like that. I once read a horror movie review in the USA Today of all places, but it stuck with me. It said the scariest movie ever is whatever you saw when you were 12 years old. That's the golden age. But in light of what I'm just saying right now, and in light of our ability to actually do the civic, do the liberal arts really well, in a purposive, intentional way, I'm actually very optimistic. I think we're able to take out the question mark and say a new golden age. So I'll open it up to any questions you might have.